2 weeks ago, we discussed Micah's idol and his personal Levite priest. And then last week, we discussed that priest, the theft of Michael's idol, and Dan's migration from their allotted territory where they murdered a group of people and stole their land. So that brings us to tonight's chapter, which seems even a little bit more dark. Question number one. Are there any indications as to when the events of the next three chapters take place historically? Second part of that is describe the events portrayed in verses 1 to 8. And why did the Levite's father-in-law keep wanting to detain them from leaving? Mark, I believe you are first.
Okay. Well, I think I have to recant of saying last time that I thought these two narratives, the previous one about the Levite and Micah's shrine and all that, and this perhaps were later in the history of Judges, because in chapter 20 and verses 27 and 28, during this narrative, over the next three chapters, it says that Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, stood in the tabernacle in those days. And so when this civil war happens that we're going to study, Phinehas is still alive. And Phinehas was a Levite who stood up during the wilderness wandering at Baal Peor when the Midianites and Moabites tried to seduce the Israelites into destruction. He's the one that stood up led the Israelites against what was happening in that day. So he was apparently a young man at that time. And now some years have passed. I looked up, Joshua lived, according to the chronology I found, 51 years after they crossed over into the land of Canaan. And then Joshua died. And Joshua was somewhat older, apparently, than Phinehas. And so that makes Phinehas an older man. And he is in the tabernacle at this time as these events come to play. Too old, perhaps, to take part. Too old to be a judge, I suppose, in those days. But what it does mean is these events are occurring fairly close to the entry into the land of Canaan. And we learned that Jonathan, the Levite in the previous two chapters, was the grandson of Moses. So that fits as well. So these events are occurring at the book. So we're jumping back in time. So Samson was near the end of the book, and now we're jumping back 300 years or so into the past. However, I didn't look that exact chronology up, but sometime into the past, a couple hundred years at least, and maybe as much as 300 years into the past. So that's the first question. The second question is describe the events. So this is a somewhat gruesome and discomforting chapter, and it begins by telling us about another Levite. So we had a bad Levite in the previous two chapters, and here we have another bad Levite. So it's like the book of Judges ends with, this is how bad things were at the beginning of the period of Judges. The Levites weren't even doing what they were supposed to do. So we have another wandering Levite who lives in the mountains of Ephraim. He takes for himself, the King James, New King James says concubine, but it means second wife. So he's a polygamist. And we know from the book of Leviticus that the high priest was to only have one wife. And so therefore, that's Leviticus 21:13. We would assume that also applied to Levites as well. They were to be monogamous. And that's, I found a Jewish source who agreed that was the case. No one knows for sure, but it's thought that the Levites were monogamous. So this man is violating that rule by having a second wife. The Bible tells us that she was unfaithful to him. She committed adultery and then fled, as you have on your map there, from the hill country of Ephraim. She fled down to her father in Bethlehem, down in the south. The Bible tells us that after 4 months of waiting, the Levite decided that he wanted to make up with her. And he did have the Old Testament command, because she had committed adultery, to put her to death. and but he decides that rather than do that, he's going to make up. The Bible says he went to speak kind words to her, and he goes to her father's house, his father-in-law's house in Bethlehem, and the father-in-law receives him very graciously, as you might imagine he would, because his daughter is guilty of the death penalty sin, and this son-in-law of his has now come not to seek her life, but instead to win her back. And so then there's a prolonged example of hospitality where the father-in-law demonstrates hospitality to them. But on the fifth day, in verse 8, we're told, near the end of the day, so sometime in the afternoon, which wasn't a wise decision to travel, the young Levite and his servant and his second wife, they leave.
Very good. Very thorough. Who else would like to address the timing or the circumstance?
So, I have a theory about the father-in-law and why he keeps wanting to detain him. So, I was noticing, actually, when Landon was reading, and somehow I just missed over this, but let's see, it's down in verse 18. The Levite explains a little bit later on that he's going to the house of the Lord before he goes back home. As Bart correctly pointed out, she should have been stoned for her sin, the sin of adultery. That was the lawful thing to do. And by the way, that this Levite, I'm not a fan of this Levite whatsoever. He's got a lot of things going, doing a lot of things that aren't very good. But I don't wonder if part of the reason why he's so quick to put her in harm's way, shall we say, is maybe out of personal injury or even revenge for what she has done. If he's going to the house of the Lord, could it be that he was going there to put her ultimately on trial? And could that be why the father-in-law continues to detain him? As maybe he's seeking retribution. That may be a little out there. I think there's some merit to it, but of course he does come down there to speak kindly with her, so that may kind of wipe it off the board. But I don't wonder. It all seems a little suspect in my mind, at least.
That's an interesting take on that. I hadn't thought about that. Clark?
It is interesting. I found one commentator, and I don't know. I didn't look up multiple translations, but when the Levite tells the older man in the village of Gibeah that I'm going to the house of the Lord, it actually can be translated, and I walk in the house of the Lord, which may mean that basically he's identifying himself as a Levite. And so maybe he's saying that none of the people of Gibeah will let me into their houses because they know I'm a Levite. I'm a holy man.
Right. Yeah, I had seen that comment. And I've seen that several places that could be translated that he was a follower of God, and those guys didn't want anything to do with him. To the timing point, Bart and I discussed this Sunday in Austin as well about the timing. And this chapter definitely ties, or the next chapter definitely ties these events to Phineas' time. But does that necessarily, just a question, does that necessarily tie it to the events of Micah's idol and the migration of the Danites? Now, we have the idea of Moses' grandson there as well, but this one I don't think necessarily ties it. I don't think there's any particular connector between these two events other than their sequential chapters. Bill.
And they're both Levites.
Yes.
Yeah, so I
appreciate that take. I hadn't thought that way. You know, I was initially thinking that this concubine's father thought that maybe he would have more blessings, you know, almost like Micaiah, you know, with having a Levite priest around, you know. I think he maybe thought he wouldn't see his daughter again. And he should have, you know, known that was a real possibility too. So I appreciate those takes.
Right. You know, that's what I assumed, was he just wanted to see his daughter and try to keep her around.
Need to move on to question number two. Why does this man not stay in the city of Jebus, choosing to stay in Gibeah? And the second part, what were the customs and expectations of hospitality at this point in Israel's history? Logan or Landon, would you like to address this?
Sure. So, as for the first question, I was wondering why it was called Jebus. And we couldn't really find anything on it in our study, but we rationalized that it must be named Jebusite. You take I-T-E off, you get Jebus. So that's where the name probably comes from, and that's exactly why the man steers away from the city. It's a city full of Jebusites, and he's, you know, racist towards them. You could say he doesn't want anything to do with them. And because of that, he steers clear of Jebus. As for the second part, for the manners, I wasn't entirely sure if this is referencing the father of his concubine or the old man who comes out to meet them. But we can see that from the man, hospitality-wise, he's completely taking care of the young man who comes to get his wife. And we see that with the old man offers to do the same thing. And so I think we can see that hospitality in Israel, you're expected to take care of the other person to the fullest. You're supposed to meet all their necessities as long as they lodge with you.
Very good. I think we see that kind of goes to the next question a little bit, but in Genesis 19 with Lot and the angels visiting, he does a very similar thing for hospitality there. We also would like to address why the man doesn't stay in Jebus, or the customs and expectations. So I think the Jebusites are named after Jebus. Bill?
Yeah, that hospitality aspect, a couple of verses in Leviticus 19:33-34, Leviticus 25:35, and then we have that same principle taught in the New Testament, Matthew 25:35, Hebrews 13 and verse 2 are familiar passages. That second part of this question, you know, travelers could stop at these cities, at courtyards, maybe a city well. And that was the process. We've seen it in several different examples. But you know, I want to go back to verse 13. I find it kind of interesting. Verse 13 is the last time we hear from this Levite servant. And it made me wonder what happened to him that night with all the other bad that was going on. So we don't know.
Yeah, I kind of wondered that same thing. Martin.
Yeah, Austin says something, and I mentioned this to Austin on Sunday, in his sermon that clicked with me because we were studying this chapter. Austin mentioned Aruna, or Orno, I forget the other name. But anyway, the Jebusite. Aruna, the Jebusite, who sold the threshing floor on the Temple Mount. To David had committed a sin, and he needed to have an altar to the Lord, and he bought that from Aruna, the Jebusite. So, and Samuel wrote probably this account, right? I guess we don't know who wrote this account, but it could have been Samuel who wrote Judges, and it's also Samuel who probably wrote the account of. So we have this Levite not going to Jerusalem because there's Jebusites there. Ooh, Jebusites. And then Samuel says, oh, wait. This Jebusite, look at this holy Jebusite who does what he's obviously he's converted to Judaism. he cares about the Lord, and he cares about God, and he sells to David the threshing floor. So I just think it's an interesting connection there that maybe these Jebusites weren't all bad. And the xenophobia of the Levite, which, by the way, the Levites in Christ's day, the Pharisees and Sadducees and the Levites, what marked them throughout the entire New Testament? Xenophobia. They hate Gentiles, and they chase Gentiles all over the place. So it's just sort of like an echo of what's going to happen 1,300 years later. Echo's not the right word.
I had this thought, and I'm not entirely sure if it's correct. As we learned from Papa's study, customs change over time. And so perhaps this doesn't mean anything, but I thought it was interesting what it said in verse 21. So he brought to him into his house, talking about the old man, and gave fodder to the donkeys, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. But obviously, we know that Jesus is the one who washed the disciples' feet. And I don't know if this became a custom later in the future, but I think we could have an example from Jesus. Obviously, we learned from Papa's lesson that we don't wash people's feet. We're not commanded to wash people's feet, but Jesus took a step and washed the disciples' feet. And so I think we're commanded to be just as hospitable, if not even more, than the Israelites were.
Awesome.
Just a quick thing here. It's interesting that the only person that offers hospitality in the city of Gibeah isn't a Benjamite, even someone who belongs there. It's an Ephraimite. And so it's another foreigner offering hospitality. Not a foreigner, I suppose, but a non-Gibeonite offering this hospitality. So Benjamin, they showed their true colors early on, exactly what kind of people they are. And coupled with Bart's thing earlier about the possibility of him saying that he's a Levite and that being the reason why they don't want anything to do with him, be very telling.
Right. Yeah. The Levites from the same area that this traveler, but the old man is from. Another interesting thing about the Jebusites, back to the very first chapter of Judges, we see in Judges 1:21 that they did not, that Benjamin did not maintain control of Jerusalem. And if you remember back to, this is probably, I think I wrote this down, I guess Joshua 10, Joshua's long day, they kill Adonai Zedek, who was the king of Jerusalem. So at one time, before this, Israel had control of the city of Jerusalem or Judas, and they had failed to maintain. Right, better move on to question number 3. What did the perverted men of Gibeah do? Why were the women offered instead of being protected? And what are the similarities between this event and the account of Sodom and Gomorrah? Levi, would you like to answer this?
Sure. So what did these guys do? I think the text is pretty clear on what happens. Why were the women offered instead of being protected? Well, this Levite guy is, they're just not good people. And it shows that he doesn't have good intentions anywhere. He's not a good person. Things are just really twisted in this chapter. What are the similarities between this event and the account of Sodom and Gomorrah? I was looking at Genesis 19. And there's a ton of similarities. There's people in the town square, and people or a person goes out to meet them, invites them into their house, and then there's perverted people who come and bang on their doors. But the main difference, I would say, is that there was nobody actually from their family sacrificed in Sodom and Gomorrah, which my dad pointed out is kind of like almost this is worse. There actually is a party that is sacrificed here, and obviously more than just killed, but very painfully so.
anybody else like to address this question about what happened and why the women were not protected, similarities between the events at Sodom and Gomorrah? Austin.
So, this may be something we don't want to spend a whole lot of time thinking about, but I think at the same time, it's worth talking about that there is nothing that goes on here in these next few verses that is God ordained. What happens here is not God's plan in any way, shape, or form for this situation to come about, for how to handle this situation, for the outcome. I think this Levite in particular, the Ephraimite first that offers him lodging, as Levi said, the same solution to the problem that Lot had in Genesis 19. And you'll notice that the angels have nothing to do with that particular thing, and they strike them all with blindness. And as he said, what makes this sadder is that there is a victim. There are no angels to strike these men with blindness. There was another thing I was looking up, and I think a couple commentators said, well, this is just indicative of how people of the time viewed women. And that may be true for how the nations viewed women, but that's never how God has viewed women. And I think it bears remembering what the Lord's standard actually is. Ephesians chapter 5, in verse 25, it says, "Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, and he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word." Later down it says, "This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband." So this was never God's design or solution to these types of problems. It's also worth mentioning, some critic today may come along and say that the only real issue wasn't with the sexual aspect, but it was with the fact that it was done without consent. That's a popular thing where people try to reinterpret the Bible to say that homosexual behavior is just fine with God. It's doing it without consent that he really had a problem with. Obviously, I think two things can be true at once, and I think he's opposed to both of them as well he should be.
Thank you. Yeah. It's definitely something we need. It's dark, but we need to think about. Who else on this question? Bill.
In both of these examples, the example with Lot in Genesis chapter 19, in this example, we have Israelite men trying to do the right thing. You know, Lot was trying to do the right thing. This older man here was trying to do the right, from Ephraim, was trying to do the right thing. So you have a couple of Israelites trying to do the right thing and being harassed, threatened, unto death, I suppose, you know, by their fellow countrymen. So I saw that as a similarity. You know, the darkness is easy and the women being offered and the surrounding of the house. So there's quite a few different similarities. And you know, we can think, I can't remember who I read from, but they mentioned Abraham. Abraham telling Sarah to lie to the Egyptians. You know, here, you know, we've got men of high esteem that have also done things, told women to do things that maybe this was a little more rampant than we want to admit. I don't really know for sure, but you know, we've got this Levite certainly didn't care for his concubine wife like he should have, certainly.
Yes. John 11, verses 49 to 50. John 11:49-50. When one of them, Caiaphas, being high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and not that the whole nation should perish." So the Jews were willing to sacrifice Jesus for their good. They were willing to give up one person's life for the good of what they considered the majority. And we see that same thing here, that human life, you know, we should see human life as precious and not view it as expendable for whatever thing that we see as good, or the good of the group. Anybody else on this question? Question number 4. What happened to the woman after this horrible and vile deed? Why was this Levite seemingly so indifferent to her condition? And could it be tied to her marital unfaithfulness prior? Cole?
So the woman dies, and the writer makes this death very dramatic. Talks about the day dawning, and she falls down right at the threshold, right on the door, right at the threshold of like safety and release. And then for B and C, I'll back up a little bit. So these people come banging on the door, wanting the Levite. So I think the Levite is obviously very scared. It's been a difficult situation. And this difficult situation shows his true colors. And maybe he tries to falsely justify himself by saying that because of her marital unfaithfulness, because she had committed adultery and that she needed to be stoned, that it was right for him. It was expedient that she should die instead of him. So then she's begging him not to. He pushes her out the door, closes it really fast, and then he spends the night with this old man locked in this probably very small house, being able to hear everything that's going on for the entire night. Probably not being able to sleep. And imagine that in that time, some sort of guilt setting. So then in the morning, when he opens up the door and sees her, he doesn't want to be confronted with his guilt. And he tries to underplay the situation. He doesn't want to say anything that shows that he was sorry, or that he regretted it. So he just says a casual, "Let's go. Let's leave."
Very good. Who else would like to talk about this event, what happened to the woman, why the Levite was indifferent, and if it was tied to her unfaithfulness?
I want to make a suggestion that goes back to the verses we just talked about. Question 3, the idea that this man was scared, these men were afraid, and the possibility that maybe this Levite was willing to sacrifice her to save his own skin. And I think we see that borne out in these verses. In particular, think about verse 27, when the man arose. Now, the master of the house, I suppose, is not the Levite, because it's not the Levite's house. But the master arises, and it seemed pretty clear to me they weren't expecting to see this woman again. because they didn't see her until the Levites opening the door ready to leave. So I think they indeed intended to send her out and did not expect her to make it through the night. So that's kind of sobering to me.
It is kind of unclear to me in this verse if it's the old man who shoves her out the door or if it's the Levite. Because it's, it just says it, put her out the door.
Yeah, and I wasn't sure if that he was the Levite or the master of the house.
Right.
Because at first the master of the house made some suggestions, here's my virgin daughter, here's a concubine, and they weren't satisfied with that.
Right. Yeah. I agree. I'm not positive. What'd you do? Anybody else on this question? So until Austin mentioned what he did earlier, I was not so convinced that it was tied to her unfaithfulness, because if he had considered her I just considered it that he didn't value her as a person, or, you know, just saw her as a lower thing than he was. Because if he had considered her to be unfaithful, there's some commentators speculated that maybe that, you know, it does say in the first couple of verses that she played the harlot in verse 2, but then it says that he went back and spoke kind words to her. So there was some, you know, what really happened there. But if she was proven as committing adultery, he could have had her stoned. And if he still suspected it and wasn't able to prove it, and he could have went through this ritual that's in Numbers 5 of drinking the bitter water. But then perhaps that is why he was going back to the house of the Lord. And, you know, that could be another reason was to have that ceremony done. Better move on to the last question. Question number 5. Why did the Levite divide his wife and send her pieces across the nation of Israel? B part, what was the collective reaction of all who heard it? And C, why is this account given to us in Scripture? And what spiritual lessons are we supposed to gather from it? Awesome.
So as far as why he divides his wife, I couldn't find, maybe someone else did, any example or precedent for this type of thing, of dividing up a person and sending them out. I couldn't find anything about that. So that this to me is one of, obviously the whole account is rather dark and gruesome, but this particular point is very tough to think about and to imagine. So I don't know exactly why, other than it's sadly her limbs that speak the greatest witness as to what happened, which is utterly heartbreaking to think about that. It's not just that you got an arm in the mail, it's what it looks like and what happened to it and the story that accompanies it. So the positive, if you want to even call it positive news, is that everyone is outraged that this happens, collectively. So that's good, at least, that there's a lot of people that think that this is really wrong. That this particular thing happened. Now, I don't know if that's their reaction to all of it or just to the receiving of these things or to hearing the story, but they're outraged. So at least that's good. Now, as far as spiritual lessons, people can add to this, but highlighted in this account is the absence of a ruling authority. So it says specifically, in the days when there was no king in Israel, there was no ruling authority that could ensure justice towards this woman. or even protect her from it happening in the first place. It highlights that when God's law is shunned, the very things that he protects are made vulnerable and justice is nowhere to be found. And again, many will say that this is an example of how poorly women were treated or regarded in those days, but I would highlight that this is how perverted and cowardly men treat women. This is not how God or God's people should think about treat women in the least. This is not a failure of God's system, but it's the failure of others to live up to it. Again, I couldn't find any example that this was, the dividing up was a biblical practice. And again, it's somewhat reassuring to know that everyone is on the same page and that God, in his justice, is ready to destroy almost the entire tribe of Benjamin because of this one event. Not because of sodomy, because it doesn't seem that sodomy was committed, although to Bill's point, I don't know exactly what happened to the servant, but because of what happened to this woman, the Lord is preparing and gives his go-ahead to destroy the tribe of Benjamin. So God takes this thing very, very seriously.
Very good. Who else would like to address why the Levite did this, why he divided her in pieces, the collective reaction of the nation, and the spiritual lessons? Mark.
So this is out there. I'll just say that at the beginning, but an interesting way to look at the book of Judges is that the two Levites that we're told about in these last five chapters are representative of the Levites of Christ's day in their wickedness. The first Levite made up his own religion, and the Pharisees and Sadducees of Christ's day, that's exactly what they did. They bound rules and traditions of men upon people, and so they made a false religion. This guy, in this chapter, hates the alien, the foreigner. He hates the idea that there's Gentiles in Jerusalem, and the Levites of Christ's day did not want Gentiles in Zion. And so, what do? They mutilated the second wife. The second wife is the bride of Christ. I know that's out there. But all I'm saying is that they, because of their hatred, their xenophobia for non-Jews, that's what led the Jews. I mean, that's a good portion of the New Testament is Paul saying, stop this, stop this, stop this. Don't be a Judaizer. That's a good portion of the New Testament. So in a way, the Jews of Christ's day can look back in the book of Judges and they see themselves. These aren't people that we don't understand. These aren't people that are far away from us, wickedness. As they read these accounts, they could say, this is us. And maybe 3,000 of those guys are the ones that obey the gospel on the day of Pentecost.
Very good. Thank you. Anybody else? To weigh in on the spiritual lessons of this. Well, for the A part, this was a hyperbolic way, but he provided hard and gruesome, albeit gruesome evidence to Israel, but of what happened. It may not have been effective if he hadn't done this, because it would have just been word of mouth and it would just got passed on, but it would have been hard to ignore what he sent around. For this, as Austin said, the collective reaction was all they saw. They were shocked about it, and that was a good thing. But we see that eventually this results. This might even delve into the spiritual part of it, but this evil results in a civil war that kills thousands, tens of thousands. And then for the C part, you see this is remembered and it becomes a sign of, or a likeness of evil. So in Hosea 9, 8 to 9. It's Hosea 9, 8 to 9. They are deeply... About that one. The watchman of Ephraim is with my God, but the prophet is a fowler's snare in all his ways. Enmity in the house of God, they are deeply corrupted, as in the days of Gibeon. He will remember their iniquity, he will punish their sins. So, Gibeah, like Sodom and Gomorrah, becomes a euphemism for wickedness. And then, let's turn over to Romans. The first chapter. Verses 24 to 27. Therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lust of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie, and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. This is the reason God gave them up to vile passions, for even their women exchanged the natural use of what is against nature. Likewise, also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust for one another. Men with men consuming what is shameful and receiving in themselves the penalty of the error which is due. If you would read, if in Coffin's commentary, he gave an opening to this chapter. It says, in these chapters is a near total collapse of moral integrity in Israel occurred. He gives this quote from Richard Allison. Here we have the sewer of Scripture, the most disgusting story in the Bible, unredeemed by admirable character or noble act. To read these chapters is to be repelled by them, and one cannot help feeling rather dirty. It is almost as bad as reading today's newspaper. But if we go back to what we read in Romans, I mean, if we think about today's newspaper, immorality is shown as a virtue. And this shows the darkness of what that is and how evil it is and what it can lead to, death and destruction. Brings us...